flank of General Lin's 13th Army Group as you both advance southward.
Sung absorbed the order, felt a flash of excitement, his heart quickening.
Yes, sir. We shall obey. You shall do more than that. You shall relive those days we all miss. You shall once again know how it feels to crush your enemy, and you shall be observed from the highest posts in China. When this is over, your name will adorn great banners.
He felt uncomfortable now, had never been celebrated in public places.
I only wish to do my duty. Do we know just when we might expect contact with the Americans? That is very likely up to you. The Americans will be wandering blind in a strange land. They do not expect to meet us on our own terms. They do not believe we have the resolve to bring this war to them. You shall show them just how mistaken they are.
A new thought rolled into Sung's brain.
Might I expect a Soviet observer in my own camp?
Peng shrugged.
Possibly. You will, of course, be the good host.
Of course.
Am I to make known my needs? Am I to allow the Soviets to know my positions, my troop strength? Chairman Mao is not amused by that prospect, but I convinced him that there is no harm. If the Soviets know our situation, they might yet be persuaded to offer us aid. Otherwise, their presence will merely be a distraction. Chairman Mao does not believe Chairman Stalin will ever support us in any way. I hold to a bit more optimism.
Then I shall be optimistic as well. I shall do what I can to secure heavy artillery or air support. Peng laughed again.
Just lead your troops, Shilan. It is not your concern what the Soviets will or will not offer us. Chairman Mao shall see to that. Now go. Return to your troops. Prepare them for what lies ahead. Prepare them for the glory that awaits their victory.
Sung stood, stiffened, a salute toward Peng.
Thank you, sir. We shall do our duty.
He turned, moved to the door, pulled it open, the guards standing to either side, eyes ahead. The air was cooler now, and Sung placed his hat on his head, saw it was dark outside. He stepped crisply toward the entryway of the great hall. More guards, smart salutes, a group of officers to one side, standing still as he passed. The steps led him down. Outside, the delicious chill of a cold night, and he glanced skyward. The stars spread out to the horizon. The excitement was inside of him still, the inspiring words of General Peng. Little of that was unusual, many of those words coming from Chairman Mao, unshakable faith in the perfect righteousness of their cause. The troops will know that, he thought. They will trust in their leaders, in why we fight. They will know of our enemy, just what kind of dishonor the Americans carry, their weaknesses, their lack of will. He moved out across a wide avenue, a flicker of lights from the buildings around the square, another glance skyward. Still, he thought, a few Soviet planes could be very helpful.
Chapter 9. Riley. The Sea of Japan, October 25, 1950. The stink from below drove the men to the open deck, desperate for gasps of fresh air. Riley climbed the final gangway with a hard lunge, burst into the open, released the breath he had held as long as his lungs would allow.
Good God! What the hell, anyway?
All around him, men were dropping, joining more men who had found any place to sit in the open air. The curses surrounded him,
one man speaking out. "Good Christ! You smell that? Must have been 10 guys with the trots all at the same time. 10 more guys puking. The heads ain't made for this. I can't go near those places. I'll just hold it. Or let it fly over the side. You won't catch me down there again, no matter what. How long we got to be on this bucket, anyhow?"
"I'm out of sea rations. Anybody spare some?"
Riley looked at the last voice, familiar. The kid, Morelli. He motioned him closer, made space on the hard deck, said, "Sit down. You better keep any talk of rations to yourself. Any one of these jackasses is liable to toss you overboard." The boy settled down beside him, seemed strangely cheerful.
"Hey, Pete, I watched the squids today. They were running a whole flock of minesweepers through the harbor. What a job, huh?"
"Picking up mines ain't my idea of a job, kid. They're taking their damn time about it, too." To one side, Killian crawled to a clear space on the hard deck, said, "I'm with him, kid. I heard one of those tubs got blown to hell. Guess those clumsy-assed swabbies dropped one. I heard the mines are rushing." "Figures."
Riley had heard the talk that the Navy's boats were still struggling to clear the harbor.
"Blew up? Didn't hear that. Might explain why the squids are moving so damn slow."
Killian said, "Marines would have had that place cleaned up by now. If I knew my buddies were out here bobbing up and down like turds, I'd sacrifice a few minesweepers to help them out."
Riley looked out toward the harbor, still busy with the work of the minesweepers. It had gone on now for more than a week, the harbor at one side too clogged with mines to allow the landing craft to move in. It was clear to all of them that the North Koreans had been caught seriously unprepared for the Marine landing at Incheon, and so someone high up the North Korean command had made sure it wouldn't happen again. The enemy's tactic had seemed to catch everyone by surprise. The transports were not expected to be at sea more than a few days. The time it took to transport the Marines from Incheon down around the Korean Peninsula, then up to the North Korean port of Wonsan. With the delay, the landing craft had been forced to bide their time, much of that in the open water. But they would not merely sit still. Concerns arose about the possibility of enemy planes, Russian MiGs first and foremost, the LSTs potentially sitting ducks. And so their crews had kept most of the LSTs in motion, motoring back and forth in the Sea of Japan. It didn't take long for the word to spread, that particular talent the Marines seemed always to possess, the art of the nickname. Very soon the entire division was calling their predicament Operation Yo-Yo. But the humor was short-lived. After more than a week of delay, the LSTs had run out of hot food. The supply of soap was exhausted, along with the drinking water in the ship's limited tanks. Bathing had become a distant memory, the men forced to endure the aroma from painfully close quarters. Then a new crisis developed. An epidemic of low-grade dysentery had spread throughout the LSTs, and with that new plague, the heads had quickly become inoperable, unable to handle the volume from so many digestive problems. The one activity that occupied those well enough to move around came from watching the minesweepers. Even now, men gazed out to one side, cursing the slow labor of the Navy. Killian sat down close beside Riley, said,
"I seen Kane down below. Green at the gills. The Sarge, too. Doc told him to get up here, air it out. Not sure Kane's got enough strength to climb anywhere."
Riley shifted away from Killian, said,
"Don't need a blow-by-blow. Jesus, you smell worse than I do. Make some space. How about it?"
Killian ignored the complaint, and Riley knew it didn't matter anyway. To the other side, Morelli smelled even worse. A sailor passed through them, a hint of a uniform, crusted with the same greasy smears that coated the Marines. Riley caught the man's odor, so very different, a strong whiff of dead fish. His face curled, a hopeless effort, and Morelli said,
"Wowee! Those Japs sure do carry a smell."
Killian cursed, said,
Why in hell we gotta ride these tubs manned by Japs? They got no good old USA squids handy? I seen one of those bastards at the stern catching some kind of grubby little fish, acting like he'd hit a home run. I heard they make fish head stew. I got a hard enough time eating the good parts. Morelli leaned forward, looked past Riley toward the Irishman.
What kind of fish they catching?
How the hell do I know? The kind they eat. The kind that make them stink like that.
Riley closed his eyes, knew he couldn't escape the conversation. He took a long, futile breath, fought the rumble low in his gut, said, They eat that stuff so we won't steal it from them. One of them offered to sell me his bowl of soup. There was a fish looking up at me. I passed. Killian leaned back against the rail.
At least you found one that spoke English. All I've been hearing is Jap talk. Nasty critters, too. Keep eyeing me like the war was my fault. They remember what we done to 'em. Count on that. I keep wondering if I put a slug between the eyes of some family member that maybe when I'm not looking, one of 'em might slip a blade between my ribs.
Riley shook his head. Not hardly. I heard they love MacArthur and all. Treat us like kings in Tokyo. They're as happy to be done with that war as we are. Happier still. They ain't got to fight this one.
Listen up, jarheads.
Riley saw Zorn, the others reacting to the captain in slow motion. Zorn's shirt as stained as the men around him.
We're expecting to land tomorrow. Gather up your gear tonight. Where's Lieutenant MacArthur?
One of the men pointed down the hatchway.
He's the one locking himself in the head, sir.
Didn't know officers were allowed to smell like that. There were low laughs, Zorn not smiling.
Make sure he gets the word. This tub will empty out as quick as we can get it done. It'll be an administrative landing. No enemy around, according to the shorebirds. The place is ours for the taking.
Killian said,
Sir, after we take it, can we give it back?
There were low laughs, but Riley could see that Zorn was in no mood for anyone's attempt at humor.
Just gather your gear. The quicker we get off this tub, the quicker I can wash my skivvies. Our luck, the first fresh water we'll find will be in those damn rice paddies.
The captain moved away, and Killian leaned back beside Riley again. Morelli said,
Administrative landing? What's that? You mean like paperwork and stuff?
Riley said, It means there's nobody there to shoot at us.
I guess that's good.
Killian sniffed.
Maybe. I was hoping we'd clean out a bunch of those bastards. Built up a fine, healthy hate for those Nook sons of bitches. Don't guess they're any different on this side of their damn country than they were at Incheon. I bet the squids would like to pound a few of them, too, after losing a couple of their minesweepers. We're going to screw around and miss out on the fun again. I just know it.
Riley crawled slowly to his feet, held himself up against the iron railing, looked at Morelli. No incoming fire is always good, no matter what this moron says. He looked at Killian. They told us we're supposed to march north. You forget that? They got work for us to do, and you can bet they'll make up for what all we missed at Incheon. We were the tail end on that one.
We'll be first in line.
Count on it. Killian leaned his head back, closed his eyes.
Hope so.
Riley glanced toward the hatchway, said,
Guess I'll go below and find the Sarge. Hate to see him so damn wrecked.
He'll be glad to hear there's not going to be a fight. The lieutenant, too. They'll feel better when they hear we're finally getting off this crate. Riley moved to the hatchway, eyed the steps leading below. The smells rose to meet him, and he hesitated, thought, My gear's down there. Gotta do this sooner or later. At least Korea's gotta smell better after this. Killian called out to him.
Hey, Pete, I'm taking bets. How long can you hold your breath?
Blue Beach, Wonsan, October 26, 1950. The men lined the seawall with jubilant cheers. the Marines curious, no one expecting a welcoming party. Riley could see that many of the men on shore were Marines, the word passing quickly that they were from the 1st Marine Air Wing, the Flyers already establishing a base on an airfield in the port. Others were Korean, soldiers to be sure, seemingly as anxious as the airmen to offer a good cheer for the incoming Marines. They had ridden off the LST on Amtrak's, the vehicles hauling them on the short journey ashore. Beside him, Killian said, "Who the hell are those jarheads, and what the hell are they doing here? I thought this was our party." The men were ordered off the vehicle, and Riley jumped down, his knees giving way, a hard fall into the dirt, his sea bag tumbling to one side. He struggled to his feet, heard the grunts and curses around him, more men doing as he did, their legs betraying them, inelegant landings. Men rolling over, all of it now swallowed by the raucous laughter from their audience. He pulled himself up, lifted the sea bag, but he was too unsteady to swing it over his shoulder. Around him, the men were nearly all down, some climbing to their feet, sea bags scattered about them. Riley tested his knees, stood at attention, felt the weakness again, said aloud, "What the hell?" Welch was there now, stretching his back, said, "Haven't felt this weak since boot. Jesus, 3 weeks on a ship with nothing to do but sit on a head. I guess it hit us pretty hard. This is ridiculous, Sarge. We're not even 30, not like some old fart whose ass is hanging." The sergeant had one hand on his gut, an uneasy look on his face. "Shut up. I've still got the trots. Need this to clear up right damn now. Feel like my intestines are boiling." From the onlookers came the calls, all manner of insults, some of it good-natured, some as vulgar as any Marine was used to. Riley looked at the others, the Koreans, let out a small laugh. "Hey, Sarge, check out those guys. Somebody's been teaching them our ways." "What the hell are you talking about?" "Those Koreans. They're giving us the one-finger salute." Behind Riley, the voice of Captain Zorn. "Cultural exchange program, bringing them our kind of civilization." Zorn moved out in front of Riley, more men dropping off the Amtrak's behind them. Zorn called out, "Tighten it up! Find your damn legs! Get your asses in line! Stand tall, you're Marines, damn it! Show those assholes what Marines look like! What the hell is this? We're out of action for 3 weeks and we turn into blubber guts? I'll kick all your asses for this. Those flyboys think this is pretty damn funny. Fox Company isn't anybody's entertainment. You got me?" Riley saw McCarthy move out in front of them. "Come on, man. They're laughing at you. You heard the captain. We're supposed to be Marines. This is embarrassing, for sure. Fall into line." Riley tried to stiffen his back, his eyes ahead, saw Goolsby step forward, trying to make a good show, standing with McCarthy. But Goolsby staggered now, turned away, dropped to his knees. Riley closed his eyes, thought, "Don't need to see that. Not now." The distinctive sound came, though, Goolsby vomiting, more laughter, more insults coming from the men along the seawall. McCarthy grabbed Goolsby under the arm, and Riley heard him say, "Just sit down. We'll get Corman out here on the double." From the far end of the line, Riley saw a jeep rolling along the formation, heard Killian behind him. "Hey, it's old Homer." The jeep pulled up, stopped with a squeal of brakes. Colonel Litzenberg dismounting. Another officer was there as well, fresh uniform, unfamiliar, and the men fell silent, the airmen as well. One of theirs, Riley thought. Great. Tell everyone what kind of idiots we look like. Litzenberg stood with his hands on his hips, a stout fireplug of a man. After a long moment, he said, "Men of the 7th Regiment, this is Major Jacoby of the Air Wing. Our reception committee belongs to him. Like many of you, I had wondered why there was no enemy awaiting us here. You may credit the Marine Airmen for making our job that much easier. The Koreans as well. These men are part of the 6th ROK Division.
They began the push up this coastline and have done much to secure this port for us.
Litzenberg paused, looked down.
I might also add that we had anticipated a reception of a far different nature. We are grateful to the ROK for removing the enemy from the formidable gun emplacements you see around you now. I believe Major Jacoby has something to add. You'll find out anyway, so I thought we'd cut through the scuttlebutt and give you the straight scoop.
Riley saw a beaming smile, Jacoby, a head taller than Litzenberg, rocking back and forth on his heels, clearly pleased.
Marines, it is my regrettable duty to inform you that your arrival here was tardy by only 2 days. I must say that the men of the 1st Marine Air Wing thoroughly enjoyed a show that was meant partly for you. It is entirely possible, of course, that there will be a repeat performance, although the entire rig has since left for other bases. Truly a shame, Marines.
Litzenberg stepped forward, and Riley saw a scowl, the colonel as annoyed as Jacoby was pleased. Litzenberg put a hand on Jacoby's arm, said,
You will all hear this in the next few days, so hear it first from me. As it was put to me a short time ago, our delay meant that the port of Wonsan was captured and secured not by the 7th Marines, as we had hoped, but by units of the ROK, the 1st Marine Air Wing, and, I regret to announce, Mr. Bob Hope.
Jacoby laughed now, said, Maybe you won't miss out next time, but it was an outstanding show. The men reacted as both officers expected, a hard groan and angry calls. The airmen watching them erupted into more cheers. Riley sagged. He'd heard about too many spectacular visits by Bob Hope, all the way back to his days in the Pacific. None of them Riley's unit could ever attend. Litzenberg kept his pose, still the scowl, waited for the men to quiet.
We are presently awaiting orders as to our next march. For now, you men will be cleaned up, fed, and made ready. I may not be able to give you a USO show, but I promise you, before we're done here, we'll show these flyboys what we were sent here to do. And where we're going. It's not likely Mr. Hope will be welcome.
Chapter 10 Smith 10th Corps HQ Wonsan, October 30th, 1950.
So instead of General MacArthur's proposed strategy of crushing the North Korean armies outright, ending this war on our terms, the British are insisting that we should appease everyone concerned by peacefully carving up Korea, creating a demilitarized buffer zone for the Chinese to occupy all along the Yalu River. Apparently there is some concern among others that if we do our jobs and win this war, we will have made things uncomfortable for some of the neighboring states. I mean, of course, China and the Soviet Union. It seems that there are those in Washington who wish us to win this war as long as we do not offend anyone doing it.
There was nothing different about Almond this time, no change in the man's amazing arrogance. Smith glanced around, various 10th Corps staff officers mimicking Almond's disdain for just who these others might be. It had been a supreme exercise in patience, but Smith felt it wearing thin. Almond's briefing droning on for more than 2 hours. There was one spark of optimism that Smith embraced, confident that, sooner or later, Almond would finally tell the Army commanders and the Marines just what they were supposed to do next. There seemed to be an opening in Almond's self-satisfied pause, and Smith said,
Sir, do we have operational maps in hand? I should like to distribute them to my regimental commanders.
Almond seemed annoyed at the question.
Of course, but first I should like to read to you General MacArthur's response to the British proposal.
Smith nodded, said in a low voice, Of course.
General MacArthur is very aware that there are those in Washington who wish to handcuff our movements. I, for one, have no idea why anyone should oppose the General's plans at all. I can only attribute this to the dirty game of politics.
General MacArthur has assured me that he is far more interested in conducting what we all know to be the dirty game of war. Our mission going forward is to drive rapidly to the Yalu River, eliminating the North Korean army along the way. Despite British concerns that our presence along the Chinese border will cause indigestion among the yellow race, you are to follow General MacArthur's orders and mine to the letter. He leaned forward, sorted through a handful of loose papers. Ah, yes, right here. To the British idea, General MacArthur has responded to the Joint Chiefs in this way. The widely reported British desire to appease the Chinese communists by giving them a strip of North Korea finds its historic precedent in the actions taken at Munich on September 29, 1938. Ammann smiled, staring out above them. Magnificent. Let no one tell you that General MacArthur does not embrace the errors of history. There shall be no such appeasement occurring here. You might think that the British would recall their disastrous efforts to make nice with Herr Hitler. Ammann paused. I might add that I offered some assistance to the general in composing that note. Smith felt his eyelids growing heavier, forced himself into alertness, glanced over at General Barr, the 7th Division's commander, staring blankly, the same emotionless expressions on the faces of his staff officers. From behind Smith came an abrupt sneeze, which seemed to wake up everyone around him. There was a low groan, and Smith turned, saw Bowser struggling with a handkerchief, a whistling blast as Bowser blew his nose.
Sorry, bloody awful cold.
Barr seemed to jump on the distraction, said, General Ammann, you did mention maps? Ammann was still annoyed, waved one hand to the side, motioning for an aide.
All right. Maps. I suppose some of us feel the need to dwell on the mundane. In my role as chief of staff to the general, I have witnessed great things, what I would only describe as a whirlwind of the momentous. So many in Washington fail to see what is being accomplished here. Even Truman, he stopped, seemed to catch himself. Well, enough about all of that. Captain, please distribute the maps among these men. I suppose marching men need to know where they are marching. If you will examine the lines indicating your specific units, you will see what we have designed. I intend to have my forces scattered all over the eastern half of North Korea. As you know, the 8th Army is occupying much of the western half. The goal, of course, is to sweep up whatever remains of the enemy's forces.
Smith ignored Ammann now, took the map, focused, Bowser sliding his chair up alongside him. Bowser sniffed loudly, said into Smith's ear,
I won't breathe on you, sir. Promise.
You're breathing on me now. Back off.
Bowser obeyed, the chair sliding back. He had a map of his own, Ammann's aide completing the task. Bowser grunted, and Smith knew why. Smith said,
General Ammann, these maps are in Japanese. Have we none of our own?
Ammann shrugged. The maps would be the same, only the names would be different. I give credit to our Japanese allies for providing us with such helpful tools. Their loyalty to General MacArthur is most extraordinary. Are the routes of march, the troops' deployments, not clear to you, Smith?
Smith scanned the map, the red lines showing the Marine units extending northward, concluding at a town called Hagaru-ri. Beyond the town to the north was a three-pronged lake, a reservoir the map named Chosin, created by what seemed to be a dam. Smith felt a familiar twist, a punch of uncertainty. He looked up at Ammann.
This is all too clear. You are intending us to advance some, what, 60 miles, 70? You have indicated that the 1st Regiment is to maintain position close to here, while the 5th and the 7th move up toward this body of water.
Ammann's annoyance seemed to bloom all over again.
More than that, Smith. Your Colonel Puller shall advance southward, protecting the rear of your division down as far as the village of... Oh, damn. What's it called?
to one side, an aide whispered loudly,
"Kojo, sir."
"Yes, Kojo. At least one battalion shall move westward to the area around Majan Ni. One would think these people could name their town something more convenient." Smith scanned the map, his hands with a hard grip on the stiff paper. "Kojo is 40 miles to the south. Majan Ni is no closer." He looked at Almond now, who seemed to ignore him, speaking in a low voice to his aide. "General, I am not comfortable extending our lines such a distance." Almond seemed surprised. "Tell me, Smith, do you not have confidence in your man Puller?" Smith stifled a low growl, closed his eyes for a brief moment. "I have complete faith in Colonel Puller, but even Puller will object to his regiment being scattered to the four winds. You would have the 5th and 7th begin their march to the north while Louis is moving in the opposite direction. Support will be difficult at best. Once Litzenberg reaches this reservoir, he will be tied to our supply bases along the coast by one primary road. Do we know the quality of that road? Its vulnerabilities?" Almond glanced toward his aide. "I told you there would be argument." He looked again at Smith. "Damn it, we have considered this plan in every detail. We have already allowed the enemy to escape our clutches by delaying our advance. That shall not happen again. Your Marines pride themselves on their speed, yes? Their ability to fight off any force with a handful of their own? I've heard all of that bravado. Well, show me why I should believe it. Puller's men will work alongside ROK units to secure your rear, your left flank, and the port of Wonsan. Your other two regiments will drive northward with as much haste as you can muster. Our goal is the Yalu River, and with that we shall end this war, Smith. Simple as that. I've already passed along the information that once the enemy has surrendered or been annihilated, two of your regiments are scheduled to return home. That should put a fire under their backsides, don't you agree?" Smith looked down. "I will not tell them that. I am much more comfortable having them in fighting spirit rather than spending their hours each day contemplating home." Almond looked at Barr. "What about you? Is the 7th Division not anxious to end this thing? Perhaps show their Marine brothers just how well the Army can manage things? I have known very few soldiers who do not carry memories of loved ones with them into combat. Homesickness is a powerful motivator. Don't you agree?" Barr glanced at Smith. "I prefer to keep such orders within my headquarters until it is an appropriate time to communicate them." Almond clamped his hands on his hips. "Is this defeatism I'm hearing? Do you not understand what the job is? The enemy is in chaos. He is retreating willy-nilly. This has become a mopping-up operation, and the sooner we can complete this, the sooner we may all return to our homes and loved ones. Good God, why the doubts? Shall I report to General MacArthur that the 10th Corps cannot keep pace with the 8th Army because we fear the enemy is still dangerous? Even Walton Walker understands the prize that awaits him, and I promise you he will seek any means to embarrass this command. They have already captured and occupied Pyongyang and are certain to reach the Yalu before us if we do not put our people into motion. All right. I have heard enough gloom from you. You have your orders, and I will see them carried out. You will advance with all speed toward the Yalu River, and should you engage the enemy along the way, you shall destroy him. Now go. Dismissed." Almond left the room, clearly disgusted, his aides in tow. The remaining staff officers gathered behind their commanders, Bowser sneezing again. Barr moved closer to Smith, said to Bowser, "Take care of that cold, Colonel. I imagine we are all to be on our toes for the next few weeks." He looked at Smith now, shook his head. "He does not believe the enemy is dangerous. That could be a mistake." Smith held up the map. "I'm being told to spread my division over dozens of miles in places we are not familiar with, supplied by a single road.
There are a number of towns along the route, and to my knowledge, none of them are secured. I'm not sure just how dangerous the enemy needs to be. There is danger enough in our own arrogance.
1st Marine Division Command Post, Wonsan, November 2, 1950. Puller was pacing, the smoke from his cigar swirling up around his head.
This is idiocy, O.P. I've got men holding off enemy troops in every direction. What kind of support am I getting?
Smith kept his eyes on the map, glanced up, saw Sexton on the far side of the room.
Captain, go someplace else.
Sexton obeyed, was out of the room, the door closing.
I would prefer if you not address me like that in front of staff.
Puller yanked the cigar from his mouth.
My apologies, General, but Christ Almighty, you got me spread over all creation out there. My battalions are too scattered to support each other. I was told there was no enemy anywhere in the area, and my men are taking fire as we speak. We've run slam into whole flocks of North Korean troops popping up like so many bands of guerrillas. We wondered what the hell happened to all those enemy who escaped us at Incheon. Well, here they are. We're on their ground now, and they don't seem to like it one bit. But Christ, O.P., I was told to expect a nuisance, flocks of Korean jackrabbits that might try to raid our supply posts. It's a whole lot more than that. Right now I'm taking casualties. We didn't expect to have to dig in just to hold a bunch of nameless hills.
He paused, a hard glare at Smith.
I know damn well that wasn't your doing. What the hell's happening?
I need them to hold on. How much heat are they taking?
Enough, but they'll hold.
I'm heading down to Kojo right now, kick some colonel in the ass. I heard panic on the radio last night. Won't have that.
Smith studied Puller's expression, tried to see past the man's obvious anger. He wouldn't ask for details, knew that Puller would tell him if the problem were serious.
Take care of things, Louis. I need all of you to do the job.
Puller pointed toward him with the cigar.
What job? Just what the hell are we doing here?
I'm to protect Wonsan from an enemy that isn't supposed to be there. What am I protecting? The supply dumps here are cleared out, if not by us, then by the damn civilians. The Navy's not taking any heat in the harbors. Nobody's shelling their damn boats. They can come and go like they want. My whole damn regiment is doing lunchroom duty while Litz and Murray go racing off to see who's first to piss in the Yalu River.
Smith let it go, knew that letting Puller blast away was the best way to handle him.
Take care of business, Louis, that's all. 10th Corps has a plan, and it comes straight from Tokyo. We're just a piece of the puzzle.
What about the enemy's plans?
Any ideas there? They just gonna let you drive a big damn convoy all the way to the Chinese border like some flag-waving parade? We should be gathered up, O.P. We have to be able to support each other.
Smith knew he was right, but there was nothing to be discussed now.
Go, Louis. See to your men. Fix that nervous colonel. Keep in touch with me. I'm going up in a helicopter. Meet with Litzenberg. He's leading the way north.
Puller shook his head.
So, 10th Corps gave you a new toy, huh?
I rode in one of those bouncy-ass things, like sitting on a basketball. Fine, go have fun. Give my regards to the convoy.
He recalled Puller's description, sitting on a basketball, the helicopter tilting wildly to one side, caught by a gust of wind. The pilot jerked the stick, gained control again, dropping the helicopter downward. Below him a small crowd of officers gathered, waiting in the road, one man signaling with his arms toward the makeshift landing zone. The craft settled down now with a soft bump, the pilot cutting the engine, leaning over to him.
Sorry for the rough ride, sir. The winds are a little tricky.
Smith nodded, said nothing,
tried to unravel the knots in his stomach. He slid out of the seat, landed shakily on the soft ground, one hand against the craft, trying to find his legs. Litzenberg was there now, a short, stocky man, intense eyes, a hard stare at Smith.
"Thank you for coming up here, General. Never thought I'd see these things so useful."
Smith glanced at the pilot, who nodded toward him.
"So far. Saves time. You have a CP?" "This way, sir. We're making good time, but I'm hearing a lot of noise from the locals."
"Let's go inside, Colonel." Smith's message was clear. No conversation needed for casual listeners. Litzenberg had the annoying habit of arguing when he should be keeping quiet, something Smith had learned to tolerate. Not the time, he thought. He followed Litzenberg to a ramshackle building, a line of trucks moving past, dust engulfing the waiting helicopter. Inside, Litzenberg pointed to a chair.
"Please have a seat, sir. Coffee?"
"No."
"Tell me about the locals. What are you hearing?"
Litzenberg sat across from him, two aides spreading a map on a small table between them.
"Nervous as the dickens. Farmers, whatnot. They keep telling us there's troops all over the place waiting for us. We've been picked at a few times, snipers mostly. Nothing to slow us down. If the enemy's waiting to slug us in the gut, they're taking their time about it. Locals keep telling us it's the Chinese. I had interpreters talking to these people, watched all manner of dramatics. These people talk to us like they're terrified, and every time we reassure them that the enemy is gone, they just get louder, preaching doom and gloom. The interpreters seem to think it's all for effect. Every village we've passed through, the people beg us to stick around. We're making friends pretty easy. Kind of strange, since these folks are all North Koreans."
Smith stared at the map, ignored the details, sorted through Litzenberg's descriptions.
"You seen any sign of Chinese troops?"
"No. Am I supposed to?"
"Not according to G2 in Tokyo." "G2 should come out here, talk to these civilians. What's his name? Willoughby?"
"General Charles Willoughby.
MacArthur trusts him like his own son. I've invited him to come out here, see what's happening for himself. Hard to pry those fellows away from Tokyo. General Willoughby insists we'll have an easy time of this, that the path is open all the way to the Yalu. My job is to take him seriously. Your job is to follow orders."
"Do you? Take him seriously?"
"No choice, Colonel. I've got orders, too. If there are Chinese in this fight, Willoughby insists with absolute certainty that they're flocks of volunteers sent south to help out their Korean allies. No more, no less."
"Well, it's nerve-wracking, sir. We're watching enemy on distant ridges, no one close enough to grab. I'm hoping we can snatch a few prisoners, see what they have to say. My guess is they're North Koreans, but who the hell knows? If there are Chinese troops standing in our way, it's a different fight. I'm no politician, General, but I know something of politics. We start killing Chinese, and the Soviets might not be happy about that. It spreads, like a stain. Next thing, the bombs start falling, big ones. We could be starting World War III. That doesn't make me comfortable, sir."
Smith didn't want this. Respected Litzenberg too much to watch him get rattled.
"I need you to do the job, Colonel. That's all. I've got very specific orders from 10th Corps. I intend to follow them."
He paused.
"I intend to follow them with great deliberation, great care, precision, if you will."
Litzenberg smiled, glanced at the staff officers around him.
"Understood, sir. We shall advance with precision."
Smith stood now, moved to a filthy window, stared out.
"I don't know what's out there, Colonel, but until I feel we can readily support each other, I'll not have three regiments strung out across half of Asia.
Our first priority is to relieve South Korean elements that have already pushed out in front of us. Maybe those fellows can give us some accurate intelligence. For all we know, Willoughby is spot on. One part of me hopes that General MacArthur is absolutely right, that this war is pretty much over. I miss my granddaughter, Colonel. I'll be as happy as every private in this division if we get home for Christmas. He turned, looked at Litzenberg. Keep that under your hat. Your staff, too. I don't need your men thinking they're just biding time out here. Keep them sharp, awake.
Certainly, sir. I'd be happy to make a wager with you about that Christmas thing.
Smith felt a rising burn of bad humor. I don't gamble. Don't mention that again.
Never again, sir.
Smith looked out through the filthy glass.
Road still looks decent enough for trucks. For now, civilians say the road gets hairy a few miles north of Hung Nam. If the topo maps are accurate, there are some pretty steep climbs farther north. Might have to put the men on their feet.
Smith saw a hazy form in the window, a man running toward Litzenberg's CP. The door opened with a loud crash, the man halting, coming to attention. He looked at Smith, said,
Sir, they told me you were here. Excuse me.
Litzenberg was on his feet now, said,
What's the problem, Lieutenant?
The man pulled himself under control, still looked at Smith.
Sir, begging your pardon, but your staff's been trying to track you down.
They know where I am.
Yes, sir. A Colonel Bowser reached us by radio. He was most insistent that you return to Wan San.
No message?
He wouldn't say, sir. I can raise him for you.
Smith looked out through the window, the helicopter waiting.
No, he looked at Litzenberg. Keep moving, Colonel. Eyes sharp. If those civilians keep talking about the Chinese, I'll make sure General Willoughby hears about it. I'll push again for Willoughby to fly up here himself. Maybe our intelligence people can be persuaded to do more than host banquets for Japanese politicians.
Smith moved out through the door, blew through the clouds of dust, more trucks moving past, curious faces watching him. He motioned to the pilot, the man quickly in his seat, firing up the engine, the rotors beginning their slow turn. He slid in beside the young man, pointed with his hand. Go! The engine revving louder, then louder still, the helicopter rising slowly, losing touch with the ground. Smith glanced up, his mind focused on the single steel bar, the only connection between the rotor and the rest of the craft, an uneasy lifeline that kept him airborne. He tried not to think of that, stared ahead, the pilot maneuvering out over the first hills, the parade of trucks spread out along the road beneath him. Smith felt a hard chill, pulled at his jacket, couldn't avoid a shiver. He glanced at the pilot, knew the man couldn't hear him, said in a low voice, Getting colder.
First Marine Division Command Post, Wan San, November 2nd, 1950.
You certain?
Sir, 10th Corps didn't have much to say, but our people picked up radio traffic from 8th Army. General Puller has radioed as well, word reaching him through the ROK units in his area.
Smith sat slowly, stared at Bowser, the other aides watching him. Bowser wiped at his nose with a handkerchief, still suffering from the cold, said, General Almond's HQ says it's only panic at 8th Army.
Is it?
I don't believe so.
Me neither. This is pretty specific.
He studied the dispatch again, felt a nagging helplessness.
8th Army is supposed to secure our left flank.
Well, it's pretty clear they're a long way from our flank, and no one seems to be moving this way at all.
Bowser stuffed the handkerchief in his pocket.
It could be blown out of proportion, sir. Some nervous aide putting out an exaggerated call. The kind of thing that drives Colonel Puller up the wall.
Smith slid through the papers, retrieved another dispatch.
This one came from Puller. Seems there's a lot of wall climbing going on. Everybody's got something bad to say except 10th Corps. They're pleased as anything this happened to 8th Army.
But do we know what happened, sir? Smith tossed the papers to one side, tried to hide a nervous quiver in his hands. He stared past Bowser, the others still silent, watching him.
All we know, Colonel, is that there's more going on out there than anyone seems to know. And that is a dangerous way to fight a war.
On November 1st, as units of Walton Walker's 8th Army advanced on their mission up the western half of North Korea toward the Yalu River, one unit of the American 1st Cavalry Division, along with several units of ROK infantry, was suddenly struck by a heavy assault from an enemy no one expected to see. The surprise was complete, although numerous reports had been issued by both air and ROK observers that enemy columns were moving in strength toward the UN positions. Near the town of Unsan, far to the north of Pyongyang, the ROK units were quickly routed, while the American 8th Cavalry Regiment was surrounded on three sides. In fighting that lasted all that night, the Americans were finally forced to flee into the hills, most of the cavalry units cut off from any support. Despite ongoing reports that no enemy was operating in their area, the 8th Cavalry's 3rd Battalion fought a brutal struggle for its very survival, the enemy forces having severed any avenue of escape. For men too accustomed to pursuing a demoralized and defeated foe, the shock of the assault was absolute. But as quickly as the enemy troops had launched their crushing attack, they withdrew from the fight. The reports flew quickly, the frantic radio calls reaching Walton Walker that one part of his glorious surge toward the Yalu River had been severely crushed. But the reports offered more than casualty counts. The enemy had left their dead and wounded as well. Descriptions reaching 8th Army HQ, passed on back to Tokyo, that the assaulting troops were not North Korean. They were Chinese. Chapter 11. Sung. Near Udomni, North Korea, November 2, 1950. They had ended the march while it was still dark, and there would be no fires allowed, no smoke to betray their presence among the hills. It was routine now, the soldiers digging shallow pits, doing what they could to secure a camouflaged hiding place for the day ahead, slipping out into thickets of brush and low trees. To the east, the first hint of dawn rose in a gray haze over a snow-capped mountain, and he shivered, the sweat of the night's march chilling his skin. He loved the sunrise, watched intently, waited for the first burst of orange that would reveal just how many mountains there were. He glanced upward, the stars fading, and he thought, "There are no clouds. It will be a good day for their planes, and so we shall stay here, wait again for dark, and when their planes go home, we shall resume the march." The tactics were simple and direct. The army would advance only at night. When mistakes were made, the Americans seemed always to be there, swarms of dive bombers, low-flying fighter planes strafing the narrow roads. Often the targets were the innocent, North Korean peasants seeking escape from Sung's troops, a wave of refugees who seemed to fear the Chinese army as much as they feared their own. Soon those people had learned just how dangerous the roads could be, and so they too had spread into the wooded hills. Or if they brought wagons, they moved only at night. A dozen yards down the hillside, officers were gathering together, a cloth bag of rice passing between them.
Sung felt the hunger himself, fought it, knew that what he carried in his own satchel would have to last. There was privilege of rank, of course. The coolies with their A-frame packs hauling the rare tins of meat and fish. His orders could direct them to his own camp, providing a feast of sorts for his staff, for those higher-ranking officers who stayed close. But he would not enjoy that kind of luxury. Not out here. Not while the men around him kept up their strength with a small ration of rice and dried beans. It was pride, theirs and his own, that his army could move on such meager supplies. There were a few trucks, most of them old Soviet vehicles from the last war, unreliable, always requiring repairs that few could manage. When a truck broke down, it would remain by the side of the narrow road, its cargo piled onto the backs of the coolies. He marveled at those men, capable of carrying their own weight on their shoulders, few of them ever speaking, certainly not to him. They went about the bone-crushing labor as though it were their only task in life. And for many that was accurate. Some were North Korean, the officers keeping careful watch on them, concerned with just how trustworthy they might be, whether they would slip away in the darkness, carrying off the precious supplies. So far there had been few reports of that. He rarely saw them on the march, the men hidden by the darkness. In the camp, Sung had been surprised to see a kind of gamesmanship evolving, competitions between them. But no one forgot that those men were the bottom rung of his army's ladder, and there had been brutality, always. Low-ranking officers making use of the whip, exercising their own power against men who had no power of their own. Sung put a stop to that when he could. Knew just how valuable those men and their A-frames were, the deeper they moved into Korea. For now the soldiers carried only what they required to fight, their rifles and machine guns, some of them American-made. It was the spoils of the victory against the Nationalists, captured weapons from a half-dozen countries. The most common weapon was the burp gun, a stocky machine gun that sacrificed accuracy for sheer firepower. There were American submachine guns as well, the ever-reliable Thompson, a close-range weapon for men who understood that when the fight came, it would have to be nearly face-to-face. In every unit came the men who carried the grenades, all shapes, varying degrees of power. Some were merely percussion, a blast that might cripple rather than kill. Others came with a valuable knot of high explosives, and most of those were the potato masher type, what Sung knew had been a favorite of the Germans in the last war. The elongated handle gave a man leverage, adding distance to his throw. And he had seen to their training, squads of grenade carriers practicing only with the strength of their arms, the accuracy of their toss. Besides the weapons, most of his men were equipped with the kind of clothing meant to combat the coming of winter, thick padded pants and coats, with a hat to match, heavy ear flaps to stave off the harsh, icy winds. They did not wear helmets, another point of pride, the officers knowing that a well-placed bullet could easily penetrate the tin hat worn by the Americans. There were few boots, the lack of tough leather explained away by the need for stealth, that heavy-heeled boots would likely be too clumsy for men accustomed to lengthy marches. Their shoes were soft canvas, rubber soles, and if they did little to ward off freezing temperatures, Sung had convinced himself and his officers that when the men moved, their feet would warm themselves. The simple answer was to keep them moving. Sung watched a gathering of coolies farther down the hill, the A-frames standing together, silent men digging into whatever rations they might be carrying. I should order the younger officers to carry those A-frames themselves, maybe just a single night. That should keep those whips silenced. He shook his head. No, you do not do such a thing to officers. You destroy a man's honor by unwise punishment.
There is no shame in this army. We shall teach the Americans about shame.
Hello, General Sung.
The voice was too loud, drawing stares from the other officers. Sung saw the larger man moving toward him, open coat, a small bottle in his hand.
Major Orlov, have you found a suitable place to sleep?
The Russian glanced toward the sunrise, said,
No, not yet. In time. It will be a long day. I do not require so much sleep.
Sung wasn't sure just how he felt about the presence of the Russian, assigned to his camp from above, perhaps higher than General Peng. He had tried to read the man. The Russian, tall, lanky, too eager to laugh. He spoke fair Mandarin with a heavy accent that made him difficult to understand. But Sung had spent a great deal of time in Manchuria, had heard enough Russian blended with Chinese dialects to understand most of what Orlov was trying to say. Sung knew his orders, that the observer was to be regarded as a guest in Sung's camp. So far, the Russian had kept mostly out of the way. No questions. The man with little curiosity about just where this army was marching. Sung watched Orlov take a long drink from his bottle, guessed it was alcohol, something Sung and most of his officers never touched. The Russian slipped the bottle into his coat, seemed to follow Sung's gaze at the new dawn.
A few more days. It will get cold, yes?
Sung nodded, pulled his coat more tightly around him.
We are prepared. I see that. Your men wear a double coat, one side brown, the other white. Either way, very useful. If there is snow, they can be well camouflaged.
There will be snow.
Yes, I can smell it. Many mornings. At Leningrad, I learned to smell many things, including the Germans. Did you know there is a different smell between German tanks and our own? I should think your enemy here must carry his own odor. If you continue to maneuver in the darkness, your men will learn.
We will continue to move in the darkness. Likely we shall fight in the darkness. It is the one advantage we have. The Americans are too much in love with their plush sleeping bags, their soft blankets. How is that in your army, Major? Are there luxuries? How badly do you miss your supplies of vodka?
He stopped, knew he had gone too far. No, you must not insult this man. To his surprise, Orlov laughed.
I do miss my vodka, yes.
He tapped his pocket. This will not last long, I regret. Orlov paused.
You do not care for my presence, eh, comrade?
I would prefer you address me by my rank. My soldiers are not accustomed to such informality.
My apologies. My orders were to show you every respect. I am privileged to be in your camp, General.
Sung looked at him, thought, What else were you ordered to do? He looked again toward the rising sun, a harsh glow now bathing the hills with sprays of light.
I am privileged to have you as my guest.
It was the same polite formality that had passed between them since Orlov arrived, just as the army had crossed the Yalu River. Orlov's comment reached him now.
I did not know you were at Leningrad. I assume you were a soldier then?
Orlov seemed to shrink, more serious now, his voice lowering.
I was a very young lieutenant. I knew nothing of war or Germans or what artillery shells can do to other young men. I learned very quickly.
Sung said nothing, kept those kinds of memories far away.
We all must learn. Perhaps one day there will be no need.
Orlov moved closer to him.
There will always be need. I know your combat record, General Sung. I know of your great struggle against the nationalists. Your army, even these men here, they march with the pride that comes from victory.
Sung held himself back, felt a pang of caution.
The officers here are veterans, many of them. The soldiers are young.
They must still learn. Orlov nodded. Yes, I heard one of your commanders saying that the soldiers consider your army to be like a great university. It is all they know, all they are meant to do. You teach them to read, you educate them in the ways of the world, they are better for it.
It was a point of pride for Sung, for many of the senior commanders in the Chinese army, that even the lowest troops learned much about Chinese history, particularly the great struggles of the recent past. Sung said,
They learn of the revolution. They are proud to march under our flag, the flag that reminds them always of their dedication to Chairman Mao.
Certainly. Well spoken. You have learned as well. I trust such knowledge will give you confidence against the guns of the Americans.
There was sarcasm in Olaf's words, Sung more uncomfortable now. He didn't want this, felt the hard weariness of the long night's march. He began to ease away, but Orlov followed, and Sung stopped, said,
Major, I must speak with my commanders. They will have reports about this march. I must know the condition of my men before we begin again tonight.
Of course, I would very much enjoy hearing of this. It is one reason I am here, as you know.
Sung looked at him, studied the man, tried to see past the friendliness of his eyes.
Are there other reasons, or am I not to ask?
Orlov held out his hands, open palms. I am in your service, General Sung. This is your command. My task is to observe for Chairman Stalin to report what I see, and possibly to offer suggestions to my superiors what the Soviet army might do to assist you.
It was the first time Orlov had used Stalin's name. He studied the man again, Orlov slowly crossing his arms, the grin returning. Sung said,
We are hopeful for such assistance as you can provide. There is a great deal of concern that we engage with an enemy far superior to what our officers have experienced. I make every effort to eliminate such fears. I believe the Americans possess superior weaponry, but I am not afraid of the American heart. They are soft, arrogant.
He paused.
I have heard that your officers have concerns as well. There is talk in Peking that you will not help us because you are afraid of what the Americans can do.
He hesitated, knew it was a dangerous subject.
My apologies. It is not my place to question the heart of your soldiers.
Orlov seemed unaffected, shrugged.
There is nothing to apologize for. You are likely correct. There is concern in Moscow, as there is surely concern in Peking, that a war with the Americans could destroy us all, the Americans included. It is not about the hearts of men, General. It is about guns. Big guns. Power versus power. Are we willing to assist your government in a fight that might destroy your precious revolution, everything you hold dear? And to what reward? Chairman Stalin has his eyes focused on Europe, on the threat to our sovereignty that still exists on battlefields soaked with Russian blood. The people of the Soviet Union have a great deal of experience with bloody sacrifice. The wounds from the last war are very fresh in our minds. Chairman Stalin is in no hurry to repeat such slaughter, no matter who suffers the most. Your revolution might be centered in this part of the world, but Chairman Stalin is aware that our enemies have great armies of occupation throughout Europe. It is there we must give our greater attention. As much as we would enjoy aiding your efforts, Chairman Stalin must keep mindful of other priorities. He loves his people and does not wish to see them bloodied for no useful cause. Is this war, right here, a useful cause?
Orlov shrugged again. That decision lies with others, of course. I am but a major. You should understand our concerns, General.
You know a great deal about Chairman Stalin. It must be an honor to have the privilege of such information.
Orlov said nothing for a long moment, his eyes locked on Sung.
Tell me, General Sung, I have wondered. Your crossing of the Yalu River was most impressive. It was an ambitious operation, and yet the Americans made almost no effort to interfere. Of course, I understood completely why you chose to cross at night, but surely you expected all of those bridges to have been destroyed by American bombs. It is reasonable to expect the enemy to put obstacles in your path, slow down every move you make.
Sung thought of the crossings, more than 100,000 of his men advancing into North Korea without a shot being heard. But he shared Orlov's curiosity about the intact bridges. Had expected at least a token of resistance.
I have no doubt that if we had made our crossing in the daylight hours, the American air forces would have done all they could to impede us. My greater concern was the discipline of the 9th Field Army Group. I am most proud that my men performed as expected.
Orlov still had the smile.
Perhaps the Americans left the bridges intact because they do not wish to antagonize your Soviet neighbors? I will admit to you that there has been concern in my government that the Americans intend to build bases along the Yalu, to threaten Manchuria and beyond.
Sung measured his words, spoke slowly.
Major, we are miles below the Yalu River even now, and we will continue to march southward until we embrace the American invasion. I do not see how bases can be built on land we have already put behind us.
Orlov shrugged.
I have been told that the Americans might not be aware just what territory you have passed. I have been told that the official dispatches coming from their headquarters in Tokyo reveal no knowledge of your army being here at all.
Sung was surprised, had heard nothing about that.
So,
of course, the Soviets have eyes in places I will never see.
You have excellent sources, Major. Are you able to communicate using the stars?
My communications have regrettably ceased since we have advanced farther south. I am completely at your mercy, General.
Sung turned slowly away, thought, somehow, I doubt that. The radios were nearly worthless, their range cut off by the great hills to the west, but the word had come to this camp, passed along a network of outposts that spread out over the mountains that divided Sung's army from those troops who were moving more toward Pyongyang. He could not know just how accurate the reports were, knew that sometimes reports of combat victory were mighty exaggerations. But he knew Lin Biao, respected the man's abilities to lead any army. If Lin had gone to such lengths to offer him a report, Sung would accept it as accurate, and so would his men. He gathered the senior commanders, the men seated around an enormous, squat tree. Sung had ordered tea, the men grateful for the small treat.
Comrades, it is a glorious day. I am to inform you that beyond the mountains to our west, the People's 13th Army Group has struck the first blow against the Americans and their puppet armies of South Korea. We have achieved a great victory.
The men called out a salute, their arms in the air, Sung absorbing their good cheer. The questions came now.
Have the Americans retreated? Have we liberated Pyongyang? Shall we join with them? Will they add to our strength?
He looked at the voice, one of his youngest generals, a man Sung suspected would one day replace him.
General Huck, your enthusiasm is welcomed, but there is a great struggle still to be waged.
I do not have every detail of the engagements beyond the mountains. While we should draw spirit from General Lin's successes, we must not forget our mission and what still lies in our path. Our foe is advancing toward us even now. Our observers have reported South Korean troops, along with units of American infantry, advancing along the East Coast. But I would also inform you that a large column of American Marines has begun their northward march out of Wonsan. Our orders are very specific. We shall observe them until the time is right, and then we shall destroy them.
As the sun had set, his army rose from the ground all around him, across narrow valleys, stretches of thick timber, tens of thousands of men making ready for the next night of their advance. They had begun to spread out far beyond the few narrow roads, the meager farm lanes that held the attention of the American plains. To their front now lay a sprawling lake, the reservoir that was the water source for farms that stretched all the way to China. For several days, other units had been marching across the rugged hillsides, ordered much farther away from the roads. They were Sung's most forward battalions, probing and scouting, soldiers who were ordered to keep their positions hidden from even the most skilled UN observers. As those units sent their reports back to their commander, Sung ordered more of his army forward, pushing them rapidly southward down both sides of the great reservoir, then spreading them farther out into the hills that rose along both sides of the primary avenue the Americans were using for the march north. With word of the great success to the west, the bloody blow that Lin's 13th Army Group had struck against the American and ROK troops, Sung's officers were energized even more. But Sung would not yet order any kind of massed assault. As he drove his troops southward, he advanced several of his divisions well past the vanguard of the American march, allowing the Americans to move up between the outstretched arms of a great pincer. To Sung's amazement, as the Marines pushed out along their single roadway, they extended their position, stretching their power into a thin ribbon that extended nearly 60 miles. He was more curious just what kind of strategy the Americans were employing. With each day, the massive advantage of firepower the Americans enjoyed seemed to be diminished, spread farther apart by decisions Sung did not understand. As energized as his commanders were becoming, Sung Shi Lun held them back, ordering only a probing confrontation, a test to learn just what kind of secret the Americans might be hiding, just what the logic was to their advance. As the Americans continued to spread themselves thin, Sung's primary mission seemed, oddly enough, to be getting easier.
Chapter 12. Riley. South of Sudong, North Korea, November 2, 1950. Their load had grown, the new equipment issued as they left Wonsan. Their green dungarees were now a heavier material, said to be windproof, covering cotton long johns many of the southern men had never seen. The jokes followed immediately, teasing from the northerners that back home, civilian long johns had the benefit of a trap door, something these long johns didn't have. If there were instructions on just how a man was to relieve himself by maneuvering through multiple layers of clothing, none of the officers had bothered to provide them. Those men who had grown up in the cold back home already understood layering, and the Southerners were learning quickly the benefit of the variety they wore now. Each man wore an undershirt beneath his usual Marine uniform shirt, covering that with a green denim jacket. The greatest burden they carried now was the heavy parka, a fur-lined, hooded coat that hung to their knees. To wear the parka during the march meant more sweating, but carrying it or slinging it over the backpack could be even clumsier. They carried gloves now, every man wondering just how he was supposed to pull the trigger of his weapon with thickened fingers. And so, many had sliced the fingertip off the wool on their shooting hand. Hanging below their backpack was a thicker sleeping bag,
what someone at Supply labeled fit for the mountains. In their packs, they carried extra socks, and on their feet, the lightweight leather boots had been replaced by what Supply had called shoe packs, a thick wool sole housed inside a watertight rubber boot, designed to keep feet dry. The men soon learned that keeping water out meant keeping sweat inside, that the longer the march, the wetter their socks. Orders had been passed to every man that once they took to the roads, they were to change socks frequently, avoiding the kind of plague some of these men could recall from a very different time fighting in the Pacific. Then it was called jungle rot. After long days in soggy terrain, a man who ignored his feet might find that his socks had become nothing more than a nasty crust that seemed to be glued to his skin. That lesson had been driven into every man who had suffered the agony of having his skin peeled from the bones of his feet. This time, the enemy wasn't the steaming heat of the jungle. Wet socks produced a variety of agonies, including blisters, and warnings came that with the coming of winter, wet feet meant cold feet, and if it was cold enough, the result could be frostbite. There were skeptics, of course, many of them the new recruits who had never endured that kind of cold, who imagined the march concluding with feet propped up in front of a campfire. But the officers did what they could to erase those kinds of pleasant expectations, the company commanders passing down the threat that anyone who ignored caring for his feet or sought to escape to the aid stations with crippled toes was to be treated with no more regard than the man who purposely shot himself in the foot. Few of the men around Riley seemed interested in testing the resolve of a man like Captain Zorn, but there were others, always the big mouths, who didn't seem to give much heed to threats from officers. To those men, the corpsmen provided incentive of their own, calmly assuring them that a case of frostbite most often ended with amputation. As they moved north from Wonsan, the nights became chillier, some of that from an increase in elevation. The cursing over the heavier loads began to quiet, the fall giving way to a North Korean winter, the mild days passing quickly to teeth-chattering nights. For now they rode in the larger trucks, the 6 by 2½ most of these men had become used to. The road itself was crude, hard-packed gravel, patches of hard dirt and some not so hard, clouds of choking dust that engulfed each vehicle in the column. They rode mostly in silence, the veterans knowing that the trucks were a luxury, that the kidney-bashing bumps were always better than hiking this ground, any ground, on foot. Word had already been passed down that farther on the roads would become steeper and quite likely more narrow. Rumors flew, sightings of Chinese units, North Korean tanks on the prowl, the men blind in their covered trucks, knowing only that they were moving farther into enemy territory. Riley felt the truck slowing, the sharp squeal of brakes. He sat forward, straightened his back away from the bone-cracking bench seat. Across from him, Welch.
Looks like the end of the ride. We sure as hell ain't burning much gas. Never seen a convoy move so slow. We could walk faster.
Lieutenant Goolsby was peering out through the canvas, voices outside, and Goolsby said,
This is it.